Hi, I'm Renee.
And I'm Anthony. We are the voices and founders of Blue Soul Earth, where we teach and we lead workshops and retreats about heart-centered living and unity consciousness.
Welcome to Blue Soul Chats, a podcast that bridges science and spirituality. We combine esoteric wisdom and the experiences that people have had for millennia and beyond with the latest breakthroughs in science, health, cosmology, physics, and the arts.
In each episode, you'll tune into cutting-edge visionaries who are making a powerful dent in consciousness from different industries and cultures around the world.
Our interviews cross boundaries and at times break conventional thinking as we redefine what reality is, what spirituality means, and what consciousness does.
Your journey to connecting to your higher self, expanding your awareness, and deepening your consciousness starts here.
Welcome, welcome everyone. We are here with Dr. Jean Houston, who I've followed for many, many years now and have been a fan of her work since her earliest books up until the latest ones, her trilogy. There's two out of three that are out, The Quest of Rose and The Return of the Avatars. But before we begin, I'd like to give those who are new to your work a little bit of background about you. Dr. Jean Houston is a scholar, a philosopher, and a researcher in human capacities, and has long been regarded as one of the principal founders of the human potential movement. She is known for her ability to combine a deep knowledge of history, culture, new science, spirituality, and human development into her teachings. And I can certainly concur with that because I've done some of her courses. A prolific writer, she is the author of 40 books, as well as several hundred more unpublished books, right? That's quite a remarkable feat. And her more recent work, which we just spoke about, the Future Humans Trilogy, and then older, but some of her evergreen and epic ones, such as A Mythic Life, The Wizard of Oz, which I couldn't put down, actually. It's very evergreen. The Hero and the Goddess, The Possible Human, In Search of the Beloved, and countless others. And all of them are worth reading, regardless of how old they are, because they really do serve as evergreen content for sure. Jean has also served as an advisor to UNICEF, training leaders in human and cultural development. She was part of a group that worked with the Dalai Lama. How exciting is that? And she's worked in over 100 countries. She also served as an advisor to President and Mrs. Clinton. And in her youth, yes, as far back as that, she worked with Eleanor Roosevelt in developing strategies to introduce international awareness and the UN to young people. Today, through the Jean Houston Foundation, she's been teaching something she refers to as social artistry, which we're going to talk about today, in the United States and around the world. So, wow, it's a much longer bio. We could actually spend a full hour just on your bio.
I'm glad we're not.
Well, welcome. I'm so honored that you decided to spend this time with us today.
Well, thank you so much, Renee. And I am just delighted to be with you. We've had a very nice conversation, who, what, when, where, and we realize that we have moved together in very similar channels for a very long time.
We have indeed. We have indeed. And I miss seeing your talks live at the SAN conference, which I used to go to every year and meander, you know, across to the other side where you used to speak in a very large room because they needed a large room because it was always filled with people who wanted to hear you speak. And I would sit on the floor and just listen to you like a child, all your stories. So I would love to start, rewind the clock a little bit, because this is something I didn't realize until I started digging more into your background, that you have a PhD in religion. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if everyone knows that, right? So I'm curious, was there a catalyst that led you to that path early on? And also, who are some of the people who inspired you?
Hmm. Well, I think I should start with the inspiration.
Okay.
That'll tell us more. When I was 14 years old, I just discovered that my beloved parents were getting divorced. I got very depressed. And somebody said, well, if you run, you can run away from your depression. Good 14-year-old advice. So I began to run from where I lived. I lived off of Park Avenue in New York City. And I would run down Park Avenue. And one day I ran into an old man and knocked him down. And he said to me with a French accent, are you planning to run like that for the rest of your life? I said, yes, sir, it looks that way. He said, well, bon voyage. I said, bon voyage, and I ran on. It was a few weeks later that I saw the old man again. He said, oh, my friend, the runner, you have a fox terrier dog. I knew one many years ago in France. Where are you going? I said, well, sir, I'm going to Central Park to think about things. I will go with you sometime, okay? Okay. I will take my constitutional. And he had a long French name, but it was so long that I called him by the abbreviated version, which sounded like Mr. Thayer. Well, Mr. Thayer and I, for the next year, would have meetings in the park. And he was like being with a kind of enlightened clown, because he was very funny too. He said, oh, John, sniff the air. Same air once sniffed by Jesus Christ. I said, Jesus Christ, sniff this ear. Yeah, I better hold my breath. No, not. Ah, Marie Antoinette. Ah, and then there were Jeanne d'Arc, Joan of Arc. And there seemed to be a lot of French people in that air. But he saw everything in terms of way things were related to everything else. We went to the local zoo on 64th Street. We would start with the bugs, and he'd bring up a bug. Oh, now he's down. Look at the bug. Look how it is growing. And then we would go and we would look at further as long as, you know, like snakes, you know, frogs. And finally, we would get to a baby carriage. Oh, Jean, look, the epiphany, the final form. And that was my training with Mr. Taylor. Anyway, he was luminous. And he would say, Jean, the people of your time will be taking the tiller of the world. But you cannot go directement. You must touch every culture, every people. I said, well, Mr. Chair, I'll try. Anyway, and then one time he was no longer there. And it turned out he was dying. But I didn't know that till a year later. My dog seemed to know, and her tail went down the stairs. Anyway, it was months later that, it was more, it was a year later, that a friend gave me a book without a cover called The Phenomenon of Man. And it was so familiar, everything that was in it. Hmm. And I read it and I said, but this is my old man. This is my old man. Do you have the cover? And my friend gave the cover and I flipped it over and there was that picture. And there was no forgetting. Mr. Thayer was Teilhard de Chardin. He was living across the street from me, around the corner.
Oh, my goodness.
At the Jesuit Rectory of St. Ignatius. So
can you imagine having that as a mentor at age 14?
Age 14, yes. So luminous. So people, the people of your time will be turning, changing the world. You must touch upon every culture, every society, which turned out to be true, which in a way I have. I've worked in 101 countries through the UN and other international agencies. And I've touched upon a whole lot, not everyone, but I think it was his inspiration, both at the time that I was 14 and perhaps elsewhere.
I assume you've read much of his work since then.
Oh, yes, certainly. Yes, a great deal of his work. Initiating impetus to my studies of spirituality, essentially spirituality, not so much religion, but as the nature of the spirituality. I mean, the mystic quest, when I have studied the lives of mystics, and I've also studied so many other modalities of how do we begin to regrow ourselves. But I would say that there is no other form of discipline that takes you further and deeper than the mystic quest. You know, you wake up You wake up, you're no longer asleep. You realize that this world is so filled with so much activation to the enticement to become who and what you really, really are. And that's why I studied the world religions and became a professor of that, but also philosophy and psychology. And I began teaching college when I was very young. Actually, I was 18. And they didn't know because I was so tall. They figured I was older. And then I've been a professor in one place or another all my life. But I also have a doctorate in psychology. My main doctorate is actually psychology and philosophy of religion. And then so much is happening with the new physics. I know you're very interested in that and have interviewed a lot of people. Yeah. Because when you actually can enter into a quantum mind state, you actually are encountering, should we call it, an alternate universe within ourselves. Mm. And learn how to solve problems that exist in our societies. Because in the alternate state, you realize that there are so many parallel realities and parallel ways and forms of solving these things. Quantum physics, which many mystics really knew about without knowing that they knew about it.
They did.
Gives us a perception of a universe that is so emotionally evocative and spiritually evocative that it changes the way we actually view the universe ourselves. And we become the change because the universe is not separate from our perception, which means that our creative imagination is truly divine. It literally interacts, our creative imagination interacts with the very blueprint of reality, you see. And it may be the part throughout which God or cosmic mind or the universe imagines the world into being. And we start to live in a world of open-ended potential. We are partners in what is getting dreamed up. We are co-creators in the great structure of being part of the living the universe, you know. And so there's no doubt that people who pursue the path of the higher orders of reality are finding that they are getting great affirmation in the new physics, because we don't just live in the universe lives in us. And a lot of my later work, especially now, has to be in ways of looking at the mystic path in such a way that we become the very incarnation of that universe in time. And people begin to study with me to discover all sorts of things related to the new physics, as well as this time of upgrading. We have to upgrade the human race. Otherwise, you know, we cannot deal with this complexity and variety of problems as we were. But what is calling us, the lure of our becoming, is to become ones who are resonant to the new understanding and become the veritable incarnation of that and who they really are, to be able to deal with the time of so much transition. In my studies of history, I find that often, times of renaissance, I love the word in Italian, rinascita, times of renaissance are almost always precluded by times of utter breakdown.
Yeah.
I mean, you notice how the Black Plague is preceded the incredible birth of the Renaissance in 15th century Italy. And this is what is happening today now.
Yeah. No, so, I'm glad that you said that, because I think a lot of people are losing hope now, and they're seeing all of these things around them kind of fall down, right? And what's happening to our democracy, and what's happening to, you know, there's this deep polarization that's happening and separateness. And so I think that's a really great reminder, is that before a really big change, especially as monumental as the one that we're dealing with now, there's chaos, you know, and we're seeing
chaos. Chaos precedes cosmos. Cosmos is where it all comes together.
There's your next book.
There we go. In fact, I am writing a book right now called, it'll be called The Magnificent Human, which deals with just these kinds of things.
It's important. I mean, we are doing a whole series on talking to physicists, and, you know, I'm a far cry from a quantum physicist for sure, or a physicist or a biologist. But I think when we look at things from the different lenses, right, something will resonate with where people are at. And I loved that you used the word resonance, because it reminds me of music. When you resonate with something, you fall into it, you become it. And I think when we become and we resonate with, we start to, how can I put this? We start to vibrate in a way that's closer to oneness and love.
Absolutely so. In your own life, where did you find the vibration?
The vibration. I think I've always known. I think when I was young and I would see the mass consciousness kind of plug into things that didn't support humanity, or as so many of us have gone through, really, when we're first introduced to institutionalized religion, where, you know, Buddhism is incorrect, Christianity is correct, right? Or whatever variation of Christianity you want to talk about. And that always seemed wrong to me. It always seemed like we were excluding the other, and how could God or source exclude the other? So I think the vibration that I most tapped into was one of wanting to really understand these differences, so I could unplug from, almost like, I hate to use the word matrix, but unplug from this mass consciousness, right? That was almost toxic. I felt like it was toxic. And so, you know, as we were talking about earlier, before we started the interview, that I went to South Africa as an exchange student, and there's no accidents in our life, just like there's no accident that you had such an incredible mentor at 14. And then to see with my own eyes, right, because you were Black, you had to live in none of it like made sense to my 17-year-old brain. And so I think when we see that and we see the pain and the suffering, we have an opportunity to start lifting our vibration to something that resonates closer to the truth of who we are.
Well, the vibration is always there, like an unheard piece of music that is waiting to be listened to. And that's why I think that In my work all over the world, I mean, I've worked in 101 countries so far.
Amazing.
I find the rising tide of spiritual awareness is everywhere. And people are saying, I'm thinking differently in the way I used to think. And I don't know where it's coming from, but by God, it's there.
Yeah.
Most unlikely people. I find that
something's shifting, right? It's like it's happening all over the planet.
And we are part of the shift, you see. We are part of the shift.
Yeah. It doesn't take everyone. It takes a small percentage to have a ripple effect in the universe.
It does. That's right. And that ripple then goes out. Also, the fact is we are made of the same substance of the universe. And the same, the basic substance of the universe is light. Mm-hmm. And we are made out of light. Truly, we are made out of light.
Photons.
We are photonic. We have our fermions. We have our photons. And I think that whatever the means we use, whether it's sports, because that's a good one, whether it's meditation, whether it's contemplation, whether it is doing beautiful things, whether it is loving, there are so many routes to the great unity. And that is happening with a spontaneity that is so extraordinary. One knows that we are not the only ones who are running our lives, you know, that we are
all interconnected.
We are all radically interconnected. And that's why so many people find that they are in a time of troubles, but also a time of radical breakthroughs. But it seems, as I said, to take the time of troubles to bring on the breakthroughs. You know, there must be another way. And you could almost hear a voice. There is. And you are part of it.
Just be quiet enough to listen to it, right? So what do you do in your own life as a regular practice to keep yourself in that vibration of oneness and connectedness? Mm-hmm.
Can I tell the truth?
Sure.
It goes back to my birth. I was not wanted, and I was the product of two people that were so unlike. My father was a comedy writer from Texas. My mother was a Sicilian lady of great depth and sweetness. Now, this is the 1930s. I'm a lot older than I look, you know. And they got married, and immediately she got pregnant. And my father was scared to death. Mary, get rid of the kid. Please, please, please. We can have as many kids as you like when I get on the Bob Hope show. My father was the comedy writer for Bob Hope.
Wow.
Not yet, but he was there. So, and my poor mother didn't know what to do. And so her dreams began. See, I didn't know this until my father was driving me to the Esalen Institute to debate Alan Watts. And he turned to me and said, "Well, kiddo, you turned out pretty good. I'm glad we decided to keep you." What? And then this story came up, this wild story.
Wow.
And I asked my mother, and she said, "Yes, that's true. But remember, you know, what a wonderful father he became after you got born." So anyway, she didn't know what to do, this nice Sicilian girl, you know, and the dream started. And it was the same dream with variations. It seemed she was taken to a palace, and at the palace, there was this beautiful tall woman in a long blue kind of Greek dress, who she called Blue Dell. And they danced and they sang. And finally, Blue Dell said to her, "Mary, you have got to keep the baby." "I know, Blue Dell, but my husband..." "Oh, ignore him. You got to keep the baby. It's a good baby. You should keep the baby." Anyway, so
going to go on and do great things.
Every night, variations on the same dream. So when I asked her, I said, "Well, Mother, this palace you went to, was it like the palaces when I took you to Italy?" "No, nothing like that." "What was it like?" "It was more like a Greek temple." "Really, Mother? And this lady Blue Dell, was that her name?" "Well, no, she had another name." "Really, Mother? What was the name?" And my mother said, "Name some Greek goddesses." I said, "Well, Artemis, Hera," you know, and I went through all them. "Athena." She said, "Athena, stop, that's who it was."
Wow.
Well, that particular archetype, which is an archetype of wisdom, of creativity, of trying to activate change in very positive ways, because that is the Athena archetype, has been part of my life all my life, you see, all my life. It's not that I worship Athena or anything like that, but an archetype, a leading present, guiding presence. Now, I've never said this in public before, but that is, I'm telling you the real story.
That's amazing, actually.
And so, you know, what does she do? I mean, she did the things that, frankly, I do. She worked with cultures in the stories, cultures, especially Greek, and civilizations, and making things work, regardless of how badly off everything was. And that's what I've had the very great good luck and good fortune to be able to do in my life.
So sometimes I wonder, right? And you've written a lot about myth. sometimes I wonder, are they myths after all? You know, are they archetypes, or were there, you know, did we manifest these gods and goddesses into being?
I think it's both and plus much, much more.
Yeah.
Archetypes, which means primeval types, are primordial types, are energies of pattern that exist in the very fabric of the universe. And how humans will see them will be according, they will be through the scrim of whatever is their culture and their belief. And then they become, as they are more and more believed, they become a very living and potent part of their reality.
And the more we pay attention to them, the more they're manifested.
Yeah, I don't worship Athena or anything like that, but I have a sense of presencing and of doing the appropriate thing. And I've noticed in my life when I'm about to do something that may not be terribly appropriate, whoa, the dream starts, or the sense of that energy. And I find myself, okay, I'll get off that path. Don't worry, I'm going on this path. And that path has taken me all over the world and into many situations, from the White House to prisons. Not that I went to prison, but I've often worked in prisons, to you name it, you know.
So I think gods and goddesses can be useful as reminders that all of these qualities live in all of us.
They do. Yes,
and
they do.
So, you know, when you need your Durga energy, get into your Durga energy, you know. Or when you're playing the piano, bring in the Saraswati energy, right?
Yes, because they are structural parts of the mind of the universe. They are structural parts. And I have a myth is something that never was, but is always happening. It's like the coded DNA of the human psyche.
Ooh, I love that.
I was a very close friend of Joseph Campbell. And we used to talk, and we also would co-teach and study the nature of myths. And he would tell great myths, and I would tell myths. And then when nobody was looking, we would have the arguments. We never did the arguments in public. And it was about the woman's myth. Women's myth. The women's heroic journey, which is not like the male heroic journey.
Not even close.
So why are you not writing? You always write about the hero's journey, not the woman's heroic journey. Well, there's never been, what do you mean there never has been one? You know, and we would have these terrible fights. And then he said, well, you write about it, which in my own small way, perhaps I have, or inspired others to do so. But that's something that is part of the big mythic change in our time, the rise of women to full partnership with men in the whole domain of human affairs. And with it, the rising of some of these great goddesses, if you will, you know, Isis and Athena and Hera and Artemis, et cetera, are very, very popular. And they are, in their variations, a Kuan Yin, all over the world. And it is the rising tide of the new story of men and women together being able to share in the depth and the breadth and the brilliance and the uniqueness of their own being and perspective that together can make a world that works.
Yeah. I mean, it's so long overdue. It's funny because I was never into goddesses myself. And now, you know, if I were to turn the camera around, there's Kuan Yin, there's Diana, Morgan Le Fay, Gaia. Gaia's over here. So it's interesting how
she is back.
Yes, she is back, most definitely. And I think that balance is, you know, it's going to play out in so many different ways in our education, our economic system, you know, politics, finally. You know, it's very long overdue. And I think that's why a lot of these goddesses are reemerging right now.
I once had occasion for a period of time to have wonderful long conversations with Hillary Clinton. And we would talk about not this kind of conversation, but what does it take to have the rising feminine taken seriously, you see. And I think that, and that was 20 years ago when we were doing these kinds of discussions together. And I think so much has happened in the last 20 years, so much. A great deal of it, not very pleasant. But as you know, just before we started doing this program, we were talking about how we're living in the time of troubles. And throughout history, you find that it is often the time of troubles, as for example, the 15th century in Europe with the Black Plague, with its pandemic, the Black Plague, was followed by the Renaissance. Rinascita, the rebirth, new art, new culture, new music, new psychology, new science. I mean, phenomenal. And that's where we also are now.
Yeah.
I just was reading today and yesterday what the greatest new discovery that has been made of the creation of a new form of energy that is not carbon-based and which can solve a lot of our problems. It's thought in the next 20 years we will have this new form of energy that is just within the last just few months been discovered.
That'll change everything.
That will change everything, yes.
Yeah, that's amazing. We're not going to go into, because you have so many books, so we decided we weren't going to go there. But I would like to spend just a few minutes on The Wizard of Oz, because even though it is a book, you know, you talk about the quantum partner in here, and you talk about, I just thought it was brilliant, couldn't put it down. And it's very evergreen, too. So
and it was Oprah's favorite, too.
Oh, was it really? Yeah, I just, you know, I mean, you literally, you know, anybody who has fallen in love with the Wizard of Oz, right? I mean, and all the archetypes and all the adventures that she goes on. And then you draw these parallels to our everyday life. And I think that's the brilliant part about the book is that every character that she meets on her journey is an archetype that exists within us. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just the beautiful, you kept weaving it together in this beautiful way. Do you want to talk about some of what led you to write this and then the takeaways for people?
Mm-hmm. Well, for the very reason that you mentioned, and it was the book in my childhood that everybody read or saw the movie.
My childhood too, by the way.
And so you grew up with it as almost the core mythos of your childhood. The fact that one is living in an outmoded situation in dreary, dust-ridden Kansas. Nothing is happening. Here's this bright, brilliant kid and nothing is happening. If only somewhere over the rainbow and those extraordinary way up high, there's a land that I dream of, you know. And I realized that everybody that I knew, all the little children I knew, that we all had some version of this going on in our lives. So it is the yearning, living in a society that is finishing and knowing that there is a lure of becoming to something and some way of being that is so much more, you see. And so it was all of our stories. Yeah. And then the very fact that you meet the disempowered, you go on the yellow brick road, which is, by the way, is a classical road in many literatures and philosophies around the world. In the Native American, it's called the road of yellow pollen, where the young heroes and heroines take, you see.
I didn't know that.
And of course, with the great, very juicy songs that go with it, we're off to see. And the whole notion that there is someone at the end of the road who understands, who can train you. I mean, I met my own wizard in Teilhard de Chardin, you know. So and then the fact that it starts in the dark gray world, and suddenly she opens the door, and you're in the world of sunshine and fun. And of a society that works. And then if you realize you have your own archetype, Glinda, the good witch who shows up, the local Athena, you know, she shows up And she is there to affirm you and to give you certain potencies, the red shoes, you know, the red shoes.
Tools that red. We use, yeah.
Yes. And the red shoes are always the shoes of new that take you on the road of new discovery, of course. And then all of the wonderful, what does Dorothy do in the world as soon as she, you know, starts to get on the road? She finds beings who need help. There's one from the vegetable world, and that's the scarecrow, you know, who's just hanging there. And, you know, who she's able to help him get down, the scarecrow. That's the vegetable world. And what do you remember? What is it that he doesn't have?
The scarecrow?
Yes.
He doesn't have he doesn't have a brain.
Doesn't have a brain, but he turns out to be the brightest of all of us.
Yeah.
He's the brightest, and then he always figures out this and figures out that, even to get down off of the fence where he's locked. He says, well, I think there is something that you could turn the, you know. And then she meets the disempowered heart.
No.
Who is the Tin Man, but he turns out to be the most emotional, the most thoughtful of them all. And then, of course, the Cowardly Lion. And he turns out to have the greatest courage, and he leaps over big places, and he saves the, you know, often it is the very quality that we think we lack, that we have living within us, waiting for us to discover it and then to bring it to life, which is a lot of my own work when I work in seminars, all the seminars and books too, that often it is what you feel that you lack, that you contain, and it is there in embryo. It is gestating in the womb of all becoming, waiting to come forth. So all in my books, what I do with stories is I really try to make them physically, psychologically, spiritually active, so that people don't just read a book or explore a story, they discover that they are the living story of a time of radical transition and growth. And it gives them back the sense of their importance, all of our importances in this world and time.
I think one of the other things that made it brilliant, I mean, there's so many brilliant things about the book, but manifestation 101, right? Yeah. So the whole idea that, you know, even Glenda at the end, when she's wanting to go home, she didn't really need the red slippers. She just needed to intend it.
That's right.
Right. And so through this whole power of intention, I mean, it's really talking about quantum, the world of quantum.
Quantum indeed.
Yeah, intend it and you will be
Frank
there.
Baum was always a quantum thinker. He was always thinking way ahead of the time. You know?
Yeah, I mean, you can always go home because home is here, right? It's so much bigger than imagination. It's creating and manifesting your reality, as she did in Oz, and mm-hmm. then as she did when she returned home to Kansas. I mean, super powerful.
Super powerful. And there were how many books followed it based on the continuity of the book in the world. By the way, his inspiration was women. Mm-hmm. His brilliant wife, who really helped him to think in brand new ways, and is equally brilliant, his wife's mother. Mm-hmm. So he had these two brilliant, extraordinary women who were empowering him, inspiring him, and getting him going. Without this woman, there would maybe have been no Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. And the fact that it was a little girl and not a little boy, right? And it was really about her love, right? Mm-hmm. It was love that just kept getting them through time and time and time again.
Always. It's really one of the masterpieces of the 20th century. It was written in 1900, by the way. So it
I remember that very early. And they changed the name, right? It wasn't even the original name that it came to be.
Well, the reason it got to be Oz is he was looking at folders in a bookcase, and it was A to B, Z to D, and he saw old Oz, and he said, "Oh, we'll call it Oz." But it has inspired, and not just inspired, but it has activated the creative juices in so many people. and given so much hope. It's truly one of the, just in terms of influence, it probably is one of the greatest books of all time.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
So that's why I wrote a book about it. You know.
Yeah, I mean, it touches all of us, I think. I just want to read one bit because, you know, we think of...
why I called it The Wizard of Us.
Yeah, I mean, so we, you know, because when you think about The Wizard of Oz, we think about it in, I don't want to say fairy tale terms, but we were introduced to it in childhood and it had a beautiful ending. So we don't like to think about the tougher lessons, right? And what I loved is that you brought up shadow work and shadow self with the witch, and that, you know, really saying and suggesting that, you know, this witch is a shadowed projection of Dorothy's own resentment and hostility taken to its ultimate form. I mean, I thought that was right. In all great initiatory experience, you write, a person meets the shadow or evil within and then must understand and conquer it before they can return home again. And then, you know, you kind of go in and ask the reader to look within themselves and what shadows are they projecting onto others, and so that they don't have to deal with them themselves. So I loved that because it was almost, you know, it was giving people ways to take a look at each aspect of these archetypes within themselves and heal, right, through doing exercises and looking at the tough stuff, the witch inside, not just the good witch, but the dark one. Anyway, highly recommend it. Love it. I can't wait to read your new stuff. So let's move on to something you call social artistry, which I thought was super fun. I thought, what a great name. And you also lead social artistry programs as well. Do you want to speak about some of those?
Well, that grows out of my work with the United Nations as well as with other international agencies. And how do you bring the fullness of your heart and mind to doing real work in real time, often in very difficult situations? We are born with an abundance of qualities that make for transformation. So social artistry is the artistry of being able to take social issues and turn them into luminous opportunities to change both self and world, you see. The way that I practice this in many, 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 many countries. And let me give you a story I have never actually told in public before. I was in an African country and I was being shot at by young people. Very, very, very young people. And how shall I put it? And I was dodging the bullets to best I could. I didn't get hit. I was behind trees. I would jump into trenches. And then I discovered that I had a big pack. I had a good-sized packet of chewing gum in my pocket. So I got up because they had run out of bullets. And there was still one boy there. And they saw me coming to them. And all but the one boy left. So first of all, I changed my attitude about them. I'm not getting killed. I've avoided it. But I know that there's something important in this meeting coming up. It's the art also of knowing you're in the right time and the right place. And all I had was a packet of chewing gum. Took one out, ran a shoe like mare, and I began to walk toward him, extending the packet of chewing gum. He was so intrigued. We sat there on a log together for the next hour, chewing happily together. And I asked him about his life. And what did he really want? And when we got down to it, he wanted to live differently.
Yeah.
He wanted to go to school. And I arranged for that. And other things in his life. Social artistry at its best is seeing the world that is trying to emerge and helping to make it happen. wherever or however, however small or however large. This boy's life was turned around, even though a few minutes before he'd been trying to kill me. They say they were terrible shots, so that was a good thing.
Wow.
Social artistry is realizing that society provides you with all manner of opportunities to be the difference that makes the difference. So in all the countries where I have done the best I can to try to teach it, I have found that life rises up to give you those opportunities. But you have to be ready to do this. So people say, oh, I want to dream to be this. I want to be dream to do that. No, it is something that life is asking you to be a game changer.
In every moment.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is a global phenomenon. It's the call to explore the nature and the development of our call to service. And many of us feel the call to service in ways that link inner commitment to outer realities. Universal plans, practical actions, passionate commitment, but what to do, where to go, how to take initiative.
Yeah.
What is key here? How to understand your role wherever and however you are as a potential leader, as a game changer, as a social artist in this most compelling moment of human history. I mean, I found that in my life, that worldwide societies are crying for the transformation of their citizens, of their organizations, of their institutions. And if they are not, then they tend to be sliding backwards into old, archaic, very dangerous times.
Yeah.
The most profound need in our time is to achieve a new humanity, a new way to nurture the human species while we work to heal our home, the planet Earth. The need is to develop the possible human in a possible society, in a more possible world. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we are willing to do is to elect ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
The art and science of making ourselves capable of transformational leadership. I think that's one of the mysteries of being human at this time. A life of alignment, of refinement, of contact with the deeper purposes and patterns of evolutionary possibility. This ultimately, my friend, is the art of world-making, spirit-catching, mind-growing, soul-quaking leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How do we get there?
Well, first of all, you get interested in it.
Yeah.
Then you find something in your social form where you know you're not going to be beaten down. So sometimes it's not necessarily within the immediate family, which knows you too well and would be surprised to see you rising to so many challenges. I say to people, you who have been pummeled, provoked, have often also been prepared to encounter the gifts and challenges of your own unique self. The unique self is key, because there's part of yourself having been born into this egregious and outrageous time in history. You also have growing within you the gifts of electing yourself. How about that? Electing yourself to a new order of being very human, seeking wisdom. Else, why are you listening to this show? No, truly, you are seeking wisdom to be here, because the 13.8 billion year experiment that has resulted in your life since the Big Bang has resulted in your life. You're here because you're present at the birth of an opportunity that exceeds our imagination. Christopher Fry, who says, "Thank God our time is now, when wrong comes up to meet us everywhere, never to leave us till we take the longest stride of soul men ever took. Affairs are now soul size. The enterprise is exploration into God."
Beautiful.
And many of you listening to this show particularly are called to take initiatives that before would have seemed unlikely, if downright impossible. But now the world has been rearranged. Yes, I mean, the reset button of history has been hit. And where before you may have known yourself as a participant in the gradual growth and even the more gradual change, your options have changed, have multiplied in your lifetime, have increased from middling rapid to rampant expeditious. Your lifetime in terms of other lifetimes is now 10 lifetimes long. And you no longer have the luxury of sloth. I was a good friend of Alan Watts. And he once said to me, talking about all of us, actually. See if I can remember. Yeah, you are the vast thing. You are the vast thing that you see far off with great telescopes. But what to do, where to go, how to take initiative, and what is key, how to understand your role. And I'm speaking to everybody who's listening. Your role as a unique gift to this time and place in this most compelling moment of human history. I mean, friends, we have the most profound task in human history, the task of deciding whether we grow or whether we die.
Yeah.
And this means involving, how shall I put it, helping people, helping communities, helping culture, helping organizations to move from dominance by one economic culture or group to circular investedness.
Oh, I love that visual, the circular, right? I love that.
Circular investment, sharing partnership. It involves putting economics back as a satellite to the soul of culture rather than having the soul of culture as a satellite to economics. Just what we have now. It involves listening past the arias and habits of cruelty of crushed and humiliated people. It involves taking a triad of soul that will challenge the very canons of our human condition. It will require that we become the unique gift we were meant to be, and then act as evolutionary partners with each other. I mean, everybody listening, I mean, the time is right. You got born into this time. Don't blame me. You know.
So ask yourself, what is yours to do, right?
What is yours to do? Yeah. We're the people of the parenthesis. We are at the end of one era and not quite at the beginning of the new one. Some people just say, I'm just going to turn off the television. I'm just going to withdraw from the onslaught. And instead, they become workaholics. Or find numbing solace in addictions or in hours staring at the television. Many of us live lives of serial monotony and the progressive dimming of our passion for life. And many are trying to understand, the people who are listening to your program here, they're trying to understand the momentous opportunity that is ours. We are among the most important people who have ever lived. I mean, we will determine whether humankind will grow or die, evolve or perish. Yeah. And so how do we prepare ourselves for such times? How do we prepare ourselves for responsibility for both the the growth of ourselves and the evolutionary process of keeping the planet going. What qualities, these are the questions we have to ask, what qualities of mind, of body, of spirit can overcome the limitations that we feel? How do we go about preparing ourselves to become the stewards of the planet, filled with enough passion for the possible to partner one another through the greatest social transformation ever known? We're in what I've called it jump time, time of whole system transition, phase transition. There is, I believe, happening now, and you're lucky or unlucky to have been born into it. There's a multiverse, a multi-leveled transformation of our entire nature in the works, as well as in the very nature and function of society. The democratization of our human potential, the wide-scale experience of aspects of ourselves we never thought to have. There's a radical need for a new natural philosophy based on the new knowledge of the cosmos, which we are, the world, the cross-cultural mix of knowledge and understanding, evolutionary directions, our own emerging realities. Your show, my friend, your show is really, as far as I can see, about the activation of the emerging reality.
Absolutely.
We have been shackled for too long with philosophies, however noble, that are limited by a much narrower view of the world. And now everything has changed.
Yeah. I mean, I think what people are starting to see now is that, you know, many, many years ago, science and spirituality were part of the same fabric.
Yes, very much so.
And they separated, right? And we had great philosophers with all these thoughts, but they only had one piece of the puzzle. And it was all about who is the, you know, new philosopher of the day that's got our creation process or why we are here, the whole human existence. Who is God? Who are we, right? What's our purpose here? Yes. And I think, you know, now we're starting to see science catch up with spirituality once again.
Right. Very much so.
You know, and that maybe we don't need to have these polar opposites, right? That as one is rising, the other is rising with it. And so, you know, I think that's the beautiful thing about our time now is seeing that happen.
Yes. People everywhere are seeing that happen. I mean, people everywhere are discovering that they're able to think and feel and know in ways to become more creative, more imaginative, and to aspire within a pretty large possibility to the challenges of our incredible lives. We are making conscious use of the complex wisdom of the body, of the mind, and beginning to achieve, this is really what social artistry does, what I try to do in all my work, to achieve an orchestral experience of ourselves and its many ecologies, which technological enhancement can never give. Mm. And that's why there is an emerging ecology of mind, of psyche, availability to each other, to share and dream each other's dreams, to feel ourselves into each other's biographies. That's part of the interpenetrating wave of the current time, psyche, memory. We are being rescaled to planetary proportions.
Yeah.
Especially as we become, and this is what you do in your show, my friend, we become resonant with our own depths. I mean, the world mind is taking a walk with itself.
That's good.
You've been doing this. I mean, you are supremely a social artist in your programs, what you do, what you dream of, what is calling you to the quickening of, I mean, what you do in your show is changing both public and private behavior.
It's increasing awareness, right? So that we're aware that the collective is calling out in pain, right? And it's showing up in ways that we don't even realize. COVID, right, was a collective calling We brought it in collectively as humanity because it was a way for Gaia to correct herself. If we see everything with purpose and intention and part of the collective all, we can see how we are starting to correct the toxic behaviors, right? That we've been out of balance for so long.
This is what you're doing in my workshops, which are continuous now, and I can tell people how to get into them because they're online now, you know, because of the new world religion, Zoomism.
So true.
Zoomism. But I give some, tell people how they can get in touch with the work and get on some of these shows. If it's okay with you, I can.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, even before we talk about that, because this will be a good segue to that, actually, is do you want to tell people what quantum partners are? Because you've written about it, and I just thought it was a great...
You have partnership. We have partnership in all of this. We are really not left alone. I mean, mine is the great archetype of the Athena. Yours may be something else, but you have within you, you have a kind of leadership, a great loving friend. This goes by many, many names. In fact, let's do a tiny little exercise, shall we?
Sure.
Everybody, rub your hands.
How fun.
Just rub, get a lot of heat in it.
Lots of heat.
Yes.
Higher self, are you listening?
Here it comes. It is the high ecological self. High self, you can call it higher self if you like. And then, eyes open or closed, just put your hands out so as if you were playing patty cake. And invite this high self to make a connection with you. And this higher level that loves you profoundly, that understands everything about you, but is there to help you in this time of transition to bring in the deeper levels of yourself and feel the connection being made with this high self. This high self. And as you begin to feel this connection, you know that this high self is working with you to help bring in the higher orders of yourself in thought, in feeling, in the way you interact with others. It's a beautiful thing, the high self. Let's just go, it has many names, but let's just call it the high self, you see. Here it comes, feeling it coming in beautifully, beautifully. And get to know this high self that sees and understands the larger story, of who and what you really, really, truly are. Something as simple as this, if practiced, will bring in a sense of light, illumination, the opening up the deeper possibilities, the higher dream. The poet says, redeem the time, redeem the unread vision of the higher dream. And that's who you bring in as you enter into partnership with this higher self. It doesn't have to be dramatic. It may be very subtle. But as you keep doing this, you will find that more and more opportunities, options, understandings will begin to come in.
I guess when we open up and say yes, right? I want to step into my calling. I want to serve, right? When it's about something bigger than ourselves, everything falls into synchronicity.
This high self is often also called the entelechy. It's an ancient Greek word that Aristotle used. It's the entelechy of a seed to become an oak tree. It's the entelechy of a baby to be a grown-up human being.
Oh, beautiful.
It's the entelechy of a melody to become a magnificent song. It's the entelechy. This high self is also known as the entelechy. It's the intellige of you and me and all of us to begin to rise out of the old forms and become the luminous, creative, heartful, kindly, transformative, loving being that you really, really are, the oak tree of yourself.
Yeah. And then to also see that seed or that oak tree in others, because when we can see each other, right, in another, then we realize that, you know, there's no difference. We are the other.
We are the other.
Yeah. And that's how we can melt away prejudices and polarities and sexual discrimination and gender discrimination, and the list goes on and on, right? I mean, if we can truly see ourselves as what you said earlier, light, then we don't see those images that have created all of those separation and polarities.
You see the true nature of reality, which is a great unity, a great oneness.
Yeah. You know, I really love that analogy you used earlier about that we're always creating and co-creating. And if we realize that what we do to another, we're doing to ourselves, right? The law of cause effect, as above, so below, right? Then we start making different choices and healthier choices.
Very much so.
So let's end with your programs and talk about that. I only did the one that I did fairly recently. I think you were doing it through maybe the Shift Network, the Evolving Wisdom Program, where you were talking about unlocking the power of quantum healing and endless energy in times of tremendous change.
Well, I'm doing programs now that are related to that.
Okay.
They have to do with the spiritual path, the mystic path. But I'm also doing ones on Get Ready. Called Get Ready. It's coming up pretty soon. And it's online. All my new programs are online. And get ready for the enormous changes that are possible for you. And that's coming up right away. And then there's another program coming up on the Mystic Path, which is perhaps our single most powerful program. And just go to Jean Houston, J-E-A-N-H-O-U-S-T-O-N, jeanhouston.com. And we would love to see you. We'd love to see you. And you'll be learning many of these things, practical, luminous, heartful, person-changing, world-activating. You will become the one. You will become the difference that makes the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can. That's what we hope for. That's what my whole life is about.
Well, last thing before we close, mainly because the selfish self, not the higher self in me, know how to stay younger and look younger because you don't age.
I don't know.
So what's the secret there? What can we do to keep?
Well, yeah, it's true. You see me here. I have no makeup on, you know, for whatever reason. It was either take out the dog or put on makeup. So I took out the dog. Wonderful, wonderful. Golden dead. Yeah. Bernadoodle. Anyway, I'll tell you about myself. And it is true. I was born in 1937, which makes me 85 years old. But they began to study me and say, what is going on with you? Because it turned out, though, my chronological age is 85. My biological age is half that.
Wow.
Early 40s. And there are secrets to it. I mean, you have to keep your mind more or less in a place of deep loving of the world, loving of the universe, loving of others, a very friendly mind, actually, in spite of how lousy people may be behaving around you. You are not.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also one, here's a very big secret. Find the year in your life when you felt the fullest and the most delighted to be alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I found 2 years. One was when I was 14. My 14th year was my best year. But also when I was 35. And I had a great burst of creativity. But find that year. And know that that year is living in you, in your body, in your mind. It still is there. And let that year, say, invite it in it, let it suffuse you when you were really in a feeling of quite wonder and astonishment of being alive.
That's the quantum portion of who we are. It's bringing in that portion. Blueprint. Yeah.
The blueprint is there.
Yeah.
And if you acknowledge the blueprint and just let it suffuse you, so that when I did that, it was about 5 years ago when I began to really look at it. And I found that I became half my age. And I've stayed there.
It's amazing.
Nobody calls me. I don't know if you can see my hands.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And my hands are not supposed to look like that.
Wow.
Those are 85-year-old hands.
It's incredible. Okay.
But they are also 40-year-old hands.
We need you. We need you to stay around for much longer because your ideas and your programs and everything else are so important. And,
However long I live, at least I try to live each day, as I say in my prayer, dear great oneness, or dear God, whatever you just say.
I love that.
Let me be a blessing to someone today. And that's what is my guidance. And then opportunities come for that to happen.
You are certainly a blessing to me today and everyone who is watching this. I know that you are a blessing to them as well. And I've been looking forward to this time with you for so long.
Glad to be to say. Thank you.
Yeah, it's incredible. So on the subsequent pages, we'll definitely be putting links to your site and your work and your books, right? I know there's a lot, but
too many to mention.
Yeah.
JeanHouston.com. One word, JeanHouston's one word.
And when is the third part of the trilogy coming out?
Not for a while because there's interest in a movie for the first two parts.
So
that may be coming up sooner than the third, but my co-writer is coming in from Holland, where she lives now, to work with me very shortly. So at least we're talking about it. Yeah, just probably within about a year and a half or so.
That's very exciting. I cannot wait to, I'm going to at least start reading the first two because I've been reading a lot of your older work, but I'm going to bring those in because certainly with a name like The Return of the Avatars.
The return of the high self really is what that means.
Yeah, we're starting to
see. We are avatars of the earth in her time of growth and transformation and how we make that happen.
Yeah. Well, Jean, what a pleasure it has been. I just honored to have had this time with you. And
honor was all mine, I assure you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Blue Soul Chats, a podcast that bridges science and spirituality. You can learn more about our work at bluesoulearth.com, studywithspirit.com, and bluesoulmedia.com.
Also, head over to bluesoulsummit.com, where you can watch video interviews, each season tackling a particular topic. We are also at Blue Soul Earth on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Clubhouse.
Join us for a future episode of Blue Soul Chats, where we hope to ignite your soul's journey, expand your awareness, and deepen your consciousness.
Thanks for being here, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and listen to previous episodes in our library.